Thank you, Mark. One of the ironies about La Boheme is that because it's so popular, everyone thinks it's an easy opera. And it's one of the rare moments where a work of unbelievable complexity somehow achieves unbelievable popularity. Usually very complex music is kept for a very small group of people who try and tell the rest of the world that they ought to like something that they don't like. And in the case of La Boheme, everyone has liked this opera. At least the people have liked La Boheme since its world premiere in Turin, which took place on February 1st, 1896. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about Turin and about Puccini at the time, and then we'll talk about the music. Turin was the first capital of modern Italy. And, when Italy was reunited, the place where it all happened was in Torino. It's called Torino in Italy, or Turin, actually, in their own dialect. It's a very ancient city. It's a city that existed way, way before the Romans came and made all the streets parallel to each other. It is said to have been the birthplace of Pontius Pilate, which I think, given the season of the year, you might find that quite interesting. It's a very mysterious city, Turin. It's considered the capital of black magic in Italy as well as white magic. And I suspect that's because it was originally a Druid place. And when the Romans came, they tore down the Druid temples. But all of the churches then that the Christians built are built over the Roman temples, which are built over the Druid temples. So there's something going on under the ground. It is said that Pontius Pilate, in fact, died in prison in Torino. And I suppose, from a frivolous point of view, you should note that the breadstick was invented in Turin, if you wanted to know where that was. And the martini, for those of you who ever have drunk a martini, that comes from Turin as well as Alfa Romeo. But more importantly, Turin also is the place where the Shroud of Turin exists, the shroud which many people believe was the shroud that wrapped the body of Jesus. And the long story that it would come to Turin, which is, just in the Piedmont, just below where the Alps stop in Italy, that they would end up there, the very place where Pontius Pilate was born and died, is a kind of one of those mysterious and spiritual stories that haunts the streets and byways of Torino. The reason why La Boheme had its world premiere in Torino is not because Torino was the greatest or is the greatest opera house in Italy. I served as music director there for 4 years, so I know a bit about the place. There has been an opera house in Turin since about 1726. The fact was that at this time, Puccini had announced that he was going to set the story of the scenes of the bohemian life of Henri Murger around the time that Leoncavallo, his arch rival, the composer of Pagliacci, also said that he was going to do that. And Puccini said that, well, that was fine, it didn't bother him a bit, let the public decide which would be the better opera and which man would win. Sanzonio was the publishing house for Leoncavallo, and Sanzonio controlled La Scala at that time, and not a single opera that was published by Ricordi was being produced at La Scala, and so, in fact, Leoncavallo's Boheme went to Scala, and Puccini's Boheme went to Torino. And that's a kind of interesting story about how politics plays such a strong role in premieres and in an opera itself. I wanted to say a little bit about that premiere, because it is a kind of interesting story. 3 years before, at the Reggio, Puccini had his first international success with his first big opera, Manon Lescaut. And because of the success of Manon Lescaut, Puccini became an international figure. But what's really interesting is that at the time of the premiere of La Boheme, something else had happened at the Reggio 2 months before that, which was the Italian premiere of Götterdämmerung by Wagner. Even though Wagner had written Götterdämmerung in 1876, it took until 1896 for it to come to Italy, and it was conducted by their music director, the man who is probably the most famous conductor in Italy, who was Arturo Toscanini. So if 2 months before you had Götterdämmerung, and then 2 months later you had La Boheme, you had quite a contrast as to what would be considered a good opera. I thought I would play you, just so you would get a sense of time, exactly the first 2 minutes of Götterdämmerung, followed by the first 2 minutes of La Boheme, just so you get a feeling of time and space. into the first act, and we've had the fourth chord played. Here's the fifth chord. Six. Seven. Eight. Which just about takes us to the 2 minute mark with a little transition here. Now, La Bohème, from a live performance that I conducted last summer at the Bowl.
Mia molce assirà. Come se addosso mi piovesse in cille, per fenicarmi a fuoco un faraone. Che fai? Nei cieli vigi guardo fumar dai mille comignoli parigi e penso a quel poltrone, un vecchio caminetto ingannatore che vive in ozio come un gran signore. Le sue rendici oneste d'un pezzo non riceve.
Le sciocche foreste che van sotto la neve.
Troppo più voglio dirti un mio pensier profondo. Un freddo cane.
Ed io, Marcel, non ti nascondo che non credo al sudor della fronte.
Ho ghiacciate le dita, quasi ancora le tenessi mollate, giù in quella gran ghiacciaia, del cuore di Musetta.
And that's 2 minutes of La Bohème. Now, that is completely astonishing to me. I mean, I did this, made this tape last night. I thought this would be an interesting experiment for you, but it was certainly an interesting experiment for me. All of La Bohème exists and is shorter than Act One of Götterdämmerung. In Götterdämmerung, which is one of the great masterpieces of all time, after that introduction I played for you, the three fates discuss the history of the world from the very, very beginning of all time up to this moment where we're about to have the end of the old regime and the end of the gods. In La Bohème, all of that discussion was about how cold two people are. And that is why most of the critics, or many of the critics in Turin, thought La Bohème was a trivial and unimportant piece, because actually nothing happens in La Bohème. Boy meets girl with cough. You know, she knocks on the door in Act One, and she dies in Act Four, and everything else is talk. Everyone talks about this, about that, what I saw over there, what she was doing over here, what was happening over there. But basically, the amazing thing about this unbelievably perfect opera called La Bohème is that it's mostly conversation. And so for a lot of the critics who are pro-German, and of course, you know, when people say, I like opera, I don't like opera, that's, for me, kind of a crazy thing to say, because there are as many kinds of opera as there are kinds of music, kinds of drama, kinds of everything. So it's like saying I don't like food or I don't like to breathe. But I mean, there's so many different kinds of opera that this is an example of how completely opposite from the point of view of time alone Now, for Wagner, he finds some kind of universality in telling stories of the gods, but when we experience the Ring of the Nibelungen, we also have a feeling that it's about families, which, of course, is what it is also about. Whereas with La Boheme, which is about kids or young people behaving in a kind of very trivial way, we also find universality. So these two composers come at, as it were, music theater from two different poles and achieve the very same thing and in very different ways. It is said that La Boheme was very much influenced by the 78 RPM, and I'm happy to say that I'm old enough to have first heard La Boheme on a series of 78s, the old Gigli Licia Albanese recording, which my grandfather, Baldassare Mauceri, bought for my mother, his daughter-in-law, because that was my mom's favorite opera. And so actually that's how I first heard La Boheme. And the funny thing about La Boheme is that it fits completely perfectly on a series of 78s. A lot of short scenes strung together. And it is thought that Puccini was very much influenced by this technology when he was writing La Boheme, but I'll talk to you more about that later. What I wanted to say to you now is I wanted to talk to you a little bit about why one might consider this a perfect opera. Let's just talk for a moment about what it's based on. There's a man by the name of Henry Murger. He spells Henry like an American, and he spells Murger with an umlaut over the U, but his real name was Henri Murger, and he made it Henry to be American or English sounding, and he put the umlaut so that people might think he was German, but he was just a Frenchman who was very affected and decided to respell his name to make himself a little bit more interesting. He had lived in the Latin Quarter, and he remembered. You know, it's been said that anybody can write a book who can remember something about his life and tell that story. And Henri Murger wrote a series of individual little stories which were published in a magazine and then collected together called Scènes de la vie bohème, Scenes of the Bohemian Life. It also became a play. And what makes this important is that it's the first time that student life is put in literature. Now we so come to expect seeing stories about teenagers or about kids in any case, but this was very, very rare. In fact, it's considered the first important moment that that happens, and the stories became enormously popular. The idea of calling it La Boheme, which means the Bohemian girl, is about Mimi. What does Bohemian mean? It does not mean people who are gypsies, but it means people from Bohemia, but it means people who live on the outskirts of society. And it is Murger who is one of the first to use that word, the Bohemian life. George Sand is writing at this time, and Balzac, and they use this phrase. And it's about kids who live, or anybody who lives on the outside of society. Many times these kids were rich and who just like took a year or two off leaving the chateau so that they could play at being poor, and then when it was all over they'd go back to daddy at the chateau and live happily ever after. It's a kind of a rite of passage thing, and so that's also important for you to know. Why is it called the Latin Quarter, which I think, by the way, a lot of people take for granted that everybody knows, and they probably don't know. In point of fact, the reason it's called the Latin Quarter is that in 1253, a man by the name of Robert Le Sorbon, S-O-R-B-O-N, actually gave the money to create the first university called the Sorbonne. And at the reason why this was such an extraordinary moment in history, Western history, was that poor people could get an education. Because up until that point, if you wanted to learn to read or write or learn about philosophy, you had to be a rich kid. The girls went to the convents, the boys studied with the monks, and that's how you learned, or you had a tutor, a private tutor. But because of the Sorbonne, people, everyday people, could learn and could learn and could write and become creative forces and good citizens. That's the Sorbonne, and the area around the Sorbonne is the Latin Quarter because the language of education was Latin. It was spoken, and that's how you learned things in Latin, and that's why it's the Latin Quarter. Now, the people who live in this area in La Boheme are of various ages. We have no idea how old they are, but we do know a lot about how they behave. What makes this opera so important is that, for the first time really, the speed of speech is the speed of the opera. One of the reasons why it is the most difficult of the standard operas to do is because, like real life, almost never does anybody speak at a slow speed, and everyone's always interrupting each other. In Act Two, there are at least two conversations going on all the time, plus the chorus is going on. And those 18 minutes are some of the most action-packed moments for a conductor and for performers, because they are all over the stage. And for you as an audience, it's like a montage. And I'll talk about movies in a moment, because montage becomes the fundamental element of the cinema, which is very much involved with La Boheme. So La Boheme is unique in that the speed, if I were to play you La Boheme and just read the words while they're saying it to you, and then play you some of Aida and read the words as someone singing that, you'll see the complete difference. However, Puccini's quite smart. Half of the opera is at the speed of speech, about the speed I'm speaking at right now. La Boheme has as many pages in the score as Madame Butterfly, but Madame Butterfly is a half hour longer. That's because Madame Butterfly is a much slower opera from the point of view of how many notes are heard per minute, whereas La Boheme starts in one and is just one of the goes. Only when Mimi enters the door do we get into what I would call ritual speed. And when she sings her aria, and when Rodolfo sings his aria, we're into the ritual speed of opera. Then we're out of it. Then Act Two is almost completely fast. Act Three, the opera changes. Now, that's one of the reasons why you love this opera so much. You know, there was a discussion about this opera is the most popular opera in the world, but a few weeks ago in the New York Times, because it's being done on Broadway, it's being done at the New York City Opera and the Met all simultaneously. Last weekend or 2 weekends ago, there were performances, three different productions of La Boheme going on. It's 2003. Imagine how extraordinary Puccini would think that. And why is that? Well, one of the reasons is the opera is so easy to understand. It is completely in two halves. The first half, Act 1 and 2, is the happy part. The second part is the tragedy. My wife and I saw Baz Luhrmann's production when it was at the Sydney Opera House. We had just gotten off a plane. We were jet-lagged. So we watched Act 1 and Act 2, and then had dinner and went to bed. And we decided that that's the vacation version of La Boheme. Because and it's wonderful, Act 1, Act 2. Everybody's happy, except again for that cough. We're really okay. I mean, everybody's reunited, and it's Christmas Eve. Hey, it's happy, you know? And that's really so brilliant of Puccini, because by the time you get to the end of Act Two, you're feeling good about everything, and then now you're seduced into the world of La Boheme, and Act Three, he's able to write his greatest music. And so the structure of it is completely wonderful. The idea that Act Four is a mirror image of Act One is actually one of those accidents. I was reading about this. It's actually quite amazing. You know, all of us, you know, have a very strong opinion about lots of stuff. And we kind of think that if you fight for your position and you win, you've won. Now, opera is the ultimate collaborative art form. Now, of course, it's movies. And in point of fact, there were five acts once in La Boheme, or at least five big scenes. And there was a huge fight between the librettist and Puccini about the act that you don't know that was supposed to exist in the courtyard outside of Musetta's house. And we actually were going to see that Mimi was going to leave Rodolfo to go off with the Viscount. And Puccini didn't want it, and the librettist wanted it, and Act Four was going to start with Mimi in bed dying. That's how Act Four was going to begin. Finally, the compromise was reached that Rodolfo would be given an aria, which now is a duet, in which he, and now, and Marcello, tell the audience what has happened. As a result of that, we can start Act Four with the same music that starts Act One. The boys can come in and do all their horsing around as they do in Act One. And then when the door opens, this time, instead of it being a little knock on the door and in comes Mimi, this time it's Musetta and Mimi, and we go to the death scene. Now, again, this was a compromise. You know, it was fought with much screaming and yelling between all of the parties who were involved with this opera. And the solution, as they compromised, turns out to be better than any position that any of the people had when they started to write this opera. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the music, because I think that that is really quite fascinating. I was thinking about this. You know, I've known this opera as long as I've known any opera, and I was trying to figure out what I would tell you about the music. The first thing that came to my mind the other day was that Puccini makes absolutely no attempt to write music as if it were 1830 in Paris. In fact, he doesn't even make any attempt to tell you you're in Paris for the most of the case. The music was written in 1895, and it sounds like it was written in 1895. And what do I mean by that? Here is Schaunard's entrance. Now, Schaunard is the musician of the boys, right? He's the musician. And it's already started, but you'll get it. Here it is.
Legna! Sigari! Bordeaux!
Legna!
Bordeaux!
E dovizie d'una fiera I destinci destinò bande di Francia.
Now, this music started interesting me the other day. Listen to it on the piano. Here's the bass line.
Mm-hmm.
very unusual for classical music. Here it is transposed. This figure is the basic figure for ragtime. Same piece, listen to that bass line. And now, with that knowledge, here is Schaunard's entrance once again. Puccini know this kind of music, and let me tell you why. Puccini was very much aware of everything going on in the world of music. He came from many generations of composers. A lot of people, you know, because musicology is basically a German invention, Germans tend not to take Italian music very seriously and tend not to write or do a lot of research about it. And there's always this feeling that then that permeates all of our education, that Italians wrote good music because they were clever or could write a good tune, whereas the Germans could construct stuff because they're German. But in point of fact, Puccini came from generations of composers that went way, way back hundreds of years, and he was completely schooled in church music and everything. He was not just a guy who happened to be able to have a good tune. He also, for example, would play the Beethoven late quartets from memory at the piano. He also studied what everybody else was doing in the world, just like Brahms did before him, and just like, say, Strauss and a few other composers of that ilk. He would know ragtime. Why? Well, in 1892, which is just about 4 years before La Bohème was written, there was something in America that was rather important. Can you figure out what that was? Well, 1492, 1892. Okay, the 400th anniversary of what we used to call the discovery of the New World, and there was a World's Fair, and where was it, you know? Chicago, exactly. The Chicago World's Fair was maybe one of the most important events for architecture, for music and art that took place in the Northern Hemisphere. That and the big Paris exhibition that took place a few years later where Debussy and Ravel heard the music of Java. That was very important for music. Now this, our World's Fair, was important because people like, and including, Scott Joplin. Now, Scott Joplin was born in Texas, right? Scott Joplin was born in 1867. He was in New Orleans at the time of the World's Fair, and he traveled up the Mississippi, went to the fairgrounds, was not allowed to perform in the fair, being a black man. So he performed on the outskirts of the fair, and he performed his rags there for many months, maybe years, we don't know, but we do know that literally thousands and thousands of people, many of whom came from Europe, heard ragtime for the very first time at the World's Fair in Chicago and brought it back to Europe. That's why, if you know the piano works of Debussy, there's a piece called Golliwog's Cakewalk, which Debussy wrote for his daughter. You know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. Those rhythms and this harmonic line that you're hearing from Schaunard is part of Puccini saying, I'm cool, I'm with it, and Schaunard is a musician of his day, and he's a popular musician of his day. He's not writing symphonies, he's writing rags. Okay, what's the most popular song of the 1890s? What's the song that goes all over Europe and all over? It's a song that was written by an American called Tarara Bumtie, first published in 1891, and it was first performed in Europe in London the next year, and the rhythm that goes da, 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 whoop, ba-dum, ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-dum. The lyrics are naughty but nice. It's about a girl who's naughty but nice, and she's a little this, a little that, and daddy doesn't like what she is, and mommy doesn't, but the boys, it's a kind of one of those naughty pre-turn-of-the-century songs. So Puccini, in fact, even refers to this rhythm, which becomes a singular popular rhythm of the gay 90s, as they were called. And here it happens right in the first act. Remember, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da, and so what happens in the first act? Here it comes. Puccini is telling you it takes place right now, and aren't these kids hip? Now, like Elektra, if you were here for the talk on Elektra, I spent a good deal of time just even with Don Giovanni. The Germans like to quote German music and show their traditions and their continuity. That's why Elektra started in D minor, because it's about the death of the father, which is what Don Giovanni's about, etc. And I talked a little bit about that. Puccini does this also. It's a subliminal use of reference that tells you what's going to happen. Here is what happens. This is the opening of the most influential work of the late 19th century, Tristan. The third note, bam, beam, bam, the fourth note, has a chord in it which becomes known forever as the Tristan chord. This chord. Tristan is about love and death. Mimi comes in Bohème, and she faints.
Si sente male.
This is the Tristan chord.
Nulla impallidisce il respir quelle scala.
This is the climax of the Tristan prelude, which is being referred to. Now here's that music of Bohème on the piano. And here again is the Tristan prelude, so you can hear how it's the same. And here is the opera La Bohème from the moment where Mimi enters and Tristan, the color of death, haunts the music.
Chi è là?
Così.
Una donna.
Right here it changes.
Di grazia, mi si spento il lume.
Ecco.
And now the Tristan chord as she feels weak. And the climax of the Tristan prelude. So anybody who knows the music of the Lyric Theater in 1896, and all of you, whether you know Tristan or not, know that this girl is haunted by death from the moment she enters the room. This music is specifically Mimi's, and I remember as a little boy finding it very uncomfortable as a 5 or 6 year old listening to La Bohème whenever I'd get to Mi chiamano Mimi and those harmonies, which I absolutely did not understand because I thought it was like some alien Martian music, whereas the rest of the opera sounded so simple. It took me a while to figure out what it was about because it wasn't until I was like 17 before I heard Tristan for the first time, and then it all became clear. Puccini uses this kind of subliminal information all the way through the opera. For example, in Act 4, the boys all play at a mock duel, and that music sounds like this. Triangle is playing a little note. Triangle. Now, Puccini wants to tell you they're children, and this is what this music comes from. It's the Nutcracker. The children are playing. here it is again as La Bohème. It's the last moment these boys are children. Fun and games are over for these boys who will never be little boys again. In Act One, because remember Act One takes place on Christmas Eve, Puccini has to tell you it's Christmas Eve somehow, right? He can't have reindeer on the roof, he can't do anything like that, so how is he going to make it Christmas? There are very few Christmas carols in Europe. Most Christmas carols that Europe sings are Christmas carols written in Hollywood, California, and there is very little tradition of that. However, the first time we hear a Christmas song, it is sung, of course, by Schaunard, because he's the composer. So he sings about Christmas Eve. And this is in Act One, and we hear this song for the first time.
Quando non lezzo di fritelle, in balsam alle vecchie strade.
When we go to Act Two, later that evening, we hear it played. Here's the piano playing that tune. And this is what it's subliminally referring to. And here it is, harmonized as Puccini would have. This is how you hear it. And when the full orchestra plays it, opening Act Two, it sounds like this. Deck the Halls is the name of that song you know, but the song actually, in looking, researching this song, turns out to go back as far, perhaps, they think, as the 16th century. It was probably written during Elizabethan England time, around the time of Shakespeare and Elizabeth I. It's actually a song about New Year's Eve, and it's probably of Welsh origin, but we know it was known all over Europe because even Mozart set this tune for piano and violin. So when Puccini wants to say, it's Christmas, he takes a melody which he's written, which is fundamentally based on something that everybody in the audience, it feels like Christmas. And why is that? Because of its reference. Now, let's go a little bit further. This ancient carol ends Act Two like this, and it has an extra twist to it. Here the piano will play those chords. Puccini wants you to think it's cold and it's winter. What's the coldest, winteriest place for an Italian to think about? Why, it's Russia. Listen to these chords. Now, here is what he is referring to. And as orchestrated by Puccini's contemporary Maurice Ravel. And when you hear it in La Bohème, it's here. Christmas song is heard, and we slowly move into pictures and exhibition. Ta-da. Now, the ta-da, which ends that act, is something that I want you to remember, right? We have to link Act Two. We all go out and have our intermission, and then we come back for Act Three, which takes place 6 weeks later. It's the middle of February. We've gone from Christmas Eve to sometime in February. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. It's that time when the night before meets the morning after. We are in a situation which has to tell us it's really cold. That cold, this cold that we just heard, is fun cold. Snowflakes on your nose, you know, Christmas Eve. It's kind of fun. Puccini takes this tune, which we know as Deck the Halls, and now plays it twice as slow and in the minor, and instead of parallel fifths with a third in it, excuse me if you don't know what I'm talking about, he takes the middle note out of the harmony, and it would sound like this. It's now frozen. Here it is in the piano. Ta-da. Remember that ta-da. Jason, could you turn it up just a bit? And now when the orchestra plays it, frozen, frozen, numbingly cold. Cello's going. Flute and harp, upper strings, no vibrato. Dead. If somebody were to describe what happens at the beginning of Act Three, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, it's cold. We are at one of the entryways to Paris. The street sweepers arrive. From an inn, we hear the end of the party from the night before and the song that was sung to us and the act before that. Then the milkmaids show up. There's checking of packages for security at the gate. All of this goes on, then Mimi enters through the snow, a little figure in black. All of that is like describing a movie, and the music does that, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how that works. You see, 1896 is a rather important year, because that's the first year that the movies were seen in Italy, and where was that? In Turin, Italy. Movies were invented around 1896 in Paris, a couple of brothers. They created this medium, which is now the most popular, complex art form of certainly the last century and perhaps this new century. A lot of people talk about the relationship of movies with music, and as one of my other lives is to study the music of the cinema and connect it with the traditions of lyric theater, I've often said this, that it's not that music sounds cinematic, but actually that the cinema is musical. You see, the cinema depends on our willingness to accept the fact that it exists through montage. You almost never see a movie without every 4 or 5 seconds there's a cut. You know, the camera's here, the camera's there, 4 things happening, a dissolve, we do this, and we just watch that like, oh yeah, la-di-da, that's how life is. And of course, we don't see anything like that. I'm looking at you, you're looking at me. I mean, you may be imagining something else, but actually, movies are not realistic, but what are they doing? The close-up, the dissolve, they're doing everything that music was already doing. Every Mahler symphony, every opera by Puccini, and certainly Wagner, who, you know, Max Steiner, who they said was the father of movie music, said, don't be ridiculous. Wagner invented it, and he wasn't kidding. Now, In a way, you can look at movies as a kind of necessary technological feat, which the eye demanded because the ear already had it, and it had it in music. Now, I'll give you a good example of this. You know, La Bohème is not called an opera in four acts by Puccini. It's an opera in four pictures. The word quadro is used, quadro as in quadratic. It's a square. It's meant to be four living, moving, as it were, pictures of scenes from the life of Bohemians in Paris. Now, you almost will never have the opportunity to see what I'm about to describe for you, but I wanted to describe it to you so you can imagine it. I, as a conductor who've conducted La Bohème, I don't know how many times, but let's say a lot, have only had the privilege to suggest this because it's what Puccini wrote and actually get it. And part of the reason for that is that a theater has to be technically equipped to do this. But we're used to, as Americans, that a curtain goes up and down. That's what you think a curtain is, curtain, thum. And this kind of curtain is called the guillotine curtain because it literally cuts off the image from top to bottom. Whereas in Europe, that's not how curtains fall. Curtains fall from the side. They come in like this, right? And the way it works to control it, of course, before there was machinery, there would be a person doing that. And on each of the two panels of the curtain, there would be somebody upstage holding and walking with the curtain so it didn't flap. Okay? That's how, in fact, it's still done in Europe. Now, if you have a theater where you expect this is how a curtain works, then what I'm about to tell you will make complete sense, and you'll understand what I talk about cinematic aspects of La Bohème. The end of Act Three, as you all, I'm sure, know, there's a double duet, which is unprecedented in music theater. You have two couples, one screaming at each other and another that are making up with each other. And when the two screaming people go off the stage, that is to say, Musetta and Marcello, we are left with Rodolfo and Mimì, who've decided to stay together. Puccini, about 2 minutes before the end of the act, says, "It starts to snow and the curtain starts to fall." Now, if you don't understand how a curtain works, you'd say, this is really odd, because at the end you're just going to see their feet, right, while they're singing, and that's actually not what happens. This is the closest thing to having a close-up before there was movies, because it absolutely obliterates everything else on the set. I'm going to play this for you, and I'm going to want you to imagine what this would be like. And I remember when I suggested this at Covent Garden, because they hadn't done it at Covent Garden probably since 1903, and I said, look, you've got the technology, let's just trust Puccini. And I remember they're saying, but people are going to start to applaud. I said, they're going to think it's a mistake. I said, well, maybe for the first second they're going to think it's a mistake. But they won't actually start to applaud because people are still singing. So let's just try it. And God bless them, we were able to do it for 8 performances, and at least we all got to experience that once in our lifetime. So this is exactly how it works. Okay, here is the music you know quite well, I'm sure. And remember the ta-da, which began the act. Here, it starts to snow, and the curtain starts to close. Guards on the curtain, close it. Now you understand the ta-da, which ended Act Two, which begins Act Three and ends Act Three. and how Puccini imagined it in his mind. I suppose the most cinematic moment and the biggest surprise is the very end of the opera itself. If ever there was a proto-cinematic moment, this is it. When Rodolfo realizes that Mimi is dead, of course, what would we all expect? A great, big, loud, sad chord. Makes sense. But this great, big, loud, sad chord, which is full of moving lines and full of pain, does something unprecedented. It starts fortissimo and makes a diminuendo to pianissimo. When it's just about spent, there's one wave that comes up and down, and that, I'm sure, is Puccini allowing us to cry. Up until that moment, it's as if the camera, us, cannot bear to look at the tragedy, and it pulls back through the window, pulling back through the rooftops of Paris. Now, let's listen to that and try and imagine what Puccini was imagining, which is undoable on the stage, but it works in our souls. Notice how it goes from loud to very soft. Quite extraordinary when you think about that, because who of us would have the genius to think in those terms? Now, at the beginning of this little talk, I said to you, La Bohème is the most popular opera in the world, and I never actually addressed the why. And I've had a hard time in the past 2 weeks, you know, going back to La Bohème, trying to find the answer. I've had discussions with various people. Yes, it's perfect. It's one of the perfect operas, and by perfect, the words are perfect. The libretto is one of the funniest. It's the opposite of Elektra in the sense, which is also perfect. In Elektra, Elektra is the only smart one on that stage, and everyone's dumb, so that we all relate to Elektra, because we know what she knows, and no one else on the stage knows that. Whereas in La Bohème, everyone is smart. Everyone is a smart ass, in fact. You know, real New Yorkers. They're all New Yorkers before, you know, New Yorkers were like that. I mean, except for Benoit and Al Cindoro, who don't know what's going on. They act like they were hit on the head with a frying pan and haven't fallen over yet. They're just like, duh. But everybody else is brilliant, brilliant. The best poet is Mimi. I mean, these people talk in the, you know, what time is it? It's time for yesterday's dinner. I mean, stuff like that. Don't you just hate lovers who behave like you're married to them? I mean, lines like that are just unbelievable. Unbelievably witty, but why is it the most popular opera in the world? Well, I think it's because no matter how old we are, I think we all regret the loss of our childhood. And although there are two women in La Bohème, La Bohème is really about a group of guys who will never be children again. You know, adolescence, the concept of adolescence was invented in the Freudian era. It was childhood, adulthood. And I think all adults have a longing to be carefree and to get away with it. I think we vaguely remember when we acted as if we knew everything and when we acted as if we were immortal, how we crossed the street in the middle of traffic, how we thought it was cool to get drunk, how we behaved irresponsibly toward people we thought we loved, and we behaved irresponsibly to our own souls and our own bodies. I think in La Bohème, we watch ourselves grow up once again, and our hearts go out to those bohemian guys, the lost boys, who, like us, will never fly to Neverland again. Thank you very much.